Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, we often hear that the Iraq war relied on overly optimistic predictions from the Bush White House and its allies about how everyday Iraqis would react to a military invasion. A new report sheds light on one aspect of that pre-war planning, the Pentagon's plans for Iraq's media. What does the report add to what we know about U.S. propaganda efforts in Iraq? We'll speak with Joyce Battle of the National Security Archive. Also on the show, women, are you trying to be superwoman, failing to be superwoman, tired of being superwoman? Any tension women might have about balancing work and family, it seems, news media are there to label and encourage. Our guest says they almost make a business of it. Selling Anxiety, How the News Media Scare Women is the new book by journalist Carol Rivers. We'll hear from her about how it works. All that's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Well, let no one accuse Rupert Murdoch of playing it close to the vest. When the media mogul made his bid to buy Dow Jones, the parent company of the Wall Street Journal, he signaled loud and clear the kind of hands-on boss he would be. Murdoch sent a letter, marked personal and confidential, to the journal's editor, Paul Steiger, telling him of his bid to buy Dow Jones and reassuring him that he would maintain the editorial integrity of the paper. Speaking of that integrity, Steiger declined to publish the information on the impending deal, saying he felt bound by the confidential nature of his potential new boss's little note. The story was eventually broken by CNBC. That move may have endeared Steiger to Murdoch, but it raised eyebrows for other journalists and for the Securities and Exchange Commission. Steiger now faces questions about when he told what to whom as part of the inquiry into possible insider trading on the Dow Jones deal. Murdoch is very clear, of course, on his feelings about the role of newspapers in society. He was quoted in a 1983 interview saying, quote, "All newspapers are run to make profits. Full stop. I don't run anything for respectability. The moment I do, I hope someone will come and fire me and get me out of the place, because that's not what newspapers are meant to be about." Close quote. Among the many people dismayed that someone with such a view might run the Wall Street Journal, Journal reporters, some 60 of whom have signed letters to board members in complaint. Journal staffers also have a union. IAPECWA union president Steve Yount told the New York Observer that they are considering various options. Of Murdoch, Yount says, quote, "If he needs us to empty the newsroom to prove we're upset, we can probably do that." Close quote.
Remember the oil for food scandal? A program that once allowed Iraq to export oil to ease the humanitarian impact of UN sanctions was embroiled in charges of malfeasance, tacked on fees and kickbacks to Saddam Hussein. The scandal was a favorite story for conservatives, supposed evidence of the hornet's nest of corruption that was the UN. Oil for food is why the Security Council would never stand up to Iraq, claimed the Washington Times in 2004 editorial, because France and Russia are being paid off by Saddam. What did Kofi Annan know and when did he know it? Demanded the story's main champion, Claudia Rossett, in an influential article for commentary. Other Rossett headlines, Turtle Bay's Carnival of Corruption and Oil for Terror. In reality, the scandal story was always pretty thin gruel, relying on the argument that the UN somehow had decision-making powers beyond those of its member states, including the U.S. But now the investigation has yielded some serious fruit, with Chevron, the second largest American oil company, being penalized for their role in a scheme in which they admit they should have known kickbacks were being paid to Saddam Hussein. Funny thing, though, about the interest of the right-wing press. Now that the villains turn out not to be UN staffers, but powerful U.S. corporations, oil for food doesn't seem to be much of a scandal anymore.
Well, last week we noted the media's response to the first debate among the Democratic presidential candidates. There were too many of them, Dennis Kucinich and Mike Gravel in particular. L.A. Times columnist Ron Brownstein even wondered if Gravel was off his meds. So how did the press react to the GOP debate a week later, which featured even more candidates, most of whom aren't polling very high? Well, the difference was striking. The Washington Post reported on May 4th that the lesser-known candidates, quote, generally acquitted themselves well, close quote. 2 days later, the Post gave an assist to the three GOP contenders who professed a belief in creationism, quote, a look at public polling on the issue reveals that the three men aren't far from the mainstream in that belief, close quote. In contrast to the Democrats, an LA Times editorial cheered the GOP's wide-open field, calling it, quote, a sign of intellectual ferment in the troubled GOP, close quote. That echoed Newsweek columnist and MSNBC pundit Howard Fineman, who wrote in an online column, quote, let's hear it for the second and third tier presidential candidates. You have to be impressed with the depth of their political passion, their knowledge, and even their track records. They represent in undiluted form the vivid primary colors of the conservative movement, close quote. The right-wing dominance of cable chat shows only underlined this point. Viewers tuning in to MSNBC's pre-debate coverage heard network analyst Pat Buchanan sing the praises of Representatives Ron Paul, Tom Tancredo, and Duncan Hunter for being true conservatives. And the pundits who were cheering on the true progressive candidates on the Democratic side? Well, they don't exist.
Stories about U.S. troops killing civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan are not hard to find in the press these days. For instance, on May 9th, a Marine testified at Camp Pendleton that his superior officer executed five apparently innocent Iraqi civilians in Haditha following a nearby attack on Marines that killed one. And according to Afghan civilians, several recent incidents involving U.S. airstrikes and military maneuvers have killed scores of Afghan civilians. According to the May 14th edition of Newsweek magazine, a preliminary U.S. military investigation found that in March, a Marine convoy in Afghanistan killed at least 12 innocent Afghan civilians after a single Marine was injured in an earlier bombing. The Newsweek report by Sami Yousafzai and Ron Moreau recited several other incidents in which the U.S. airstrikes and maneuvers killed Afghan civilians in situations that may or may not have been intentional but were nonetheless deadly. But the writers seemed befuddled that Afghans would be enraged by the civilian killings. The headline of the report, Collateral Disasters, seemed to refer to the public relations fallout caused by the killings rather than the killings themselves, while the body of the report somehow managed to live down to its subhead's wonderment at Afghans' tendency to hate U.S. bombing that continues to target civilians. Quote, in Afghanistan's lopsided ethos, every civilian death counts against the Americans, closed quote. Elsewhere, Yousafzai and Moreau seem to find something ironic, their term, about Afghans who think a Taliban attack happened because there was a U.S. base in their town. And the reporters lament that every U.S. airstrike, even if precision in nature, is just, quote, one more Psy war victory for the Taliban, close quote, because the resultant deaths make people hate U.S. troops. Go figure.
And finally, CNN host Lou Dobbs was profiled on the May 6th 60 Minutes, and CBS reporter Leslie Stahl decided to ask him about a claim aired on his show about, here's a shocker, immigration. Dobbs' show once alleged that 7,000 new cases of leprosy, or Hansen's disease, had been discovered in the past 3 years, presumably due to immigration. Dobbs' response to Stahl was curious, quote, well, I can tell you this, if we reported it, it's a fact. Close quote. It's odd to hear an actual journalist make the if I say it, it's true argument, but that's Lou Dobbs for you. And it turns out he's wrong. As Stahl pointed out, leprosy statistics compiled by the Department of Health and Human Services found 7,000 cases over the last 30 years. Not 3 years, 30 years. Well, instead of acknowledging the mistake on his show the next day, Dobbs went on the attack. His defense? Well, CNN quoted a source who gave that 7,000 number. He then went on to clarify the matter by explaining, quote, it's remarkable that this whatever confusion or confoundment over 7,000 cases, they actually keep a registry of cases of leprosy. And the fact that it rose was because, one assumes, because we don't know for sure, but two basic influences, unscreened illegal immigrants coming into this country primarily from South Asia, and secondly, far better reporting, close quote. Dobbs is right when he says they keep records on leprosy, but all those records do is undermine his case. The Centers for Disease Control, for example, note that reported cases of leprosy have been declining for the past 20 years. The latest figures suggest less than 200 cases are reported per year. But then, those are just facts, and when it comes to immigration and Lou Dobbs, the facts just don't seem to matter.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
Even the most die-hard Iraq War supporters will usually agree that the Pentagon's post-invasion planning was a mess, if any existed at all. It's a convenient strategy. The war was a good idea, but it was poorly executed. And it permits White House contenders like John McCain to show some distance from the Bush administration. The extent of those misjudgments, we're often told, well, that will be for historians to sort out. But it doesn't necessarily need to take that long. The National Security Archive has revealed one aspect of Iraq planning that might shed some light on the assumptions guiding the White House's drive to invade Iraq. Joyce Battle is a Middle East analyst at the National Security Archive, and she pieced together this document called Iraq, the Media War Plan. Joyce Battle, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this report stems from a Freedom of Information Act request from the group, so let's go back to that point. What motivated you to look at this particular issue?
Well, it was clear that the Bush administration was conducting a public relations campaign in order to win support for an invasion of Iraq. I was interested in seeing what sort of planning they were undertaking in terms of a public information campaign to persuade Iraqis to cooperate with the U.S. government after an invasion had occurred. So I submitted a very simple FOIA request asking for media planning that was being undertaken prior to March 2003 when the invasion occurred. And they released a document entitled White Paper, Rapid Reaction Media Team Concept. It was prepared in January 2003 when the administration was finalizing its preparations for the war. It was put together by several offices within the Defense Department, and it outlines what the planners saw as a bridge from the media universe that existed under the Saddam government, a bridge leading to what they called a new Iraqi free media after the invasion occurred.
Now, the creation of this rapid reaction media team, what were they going to do exactly?
They were going to bring together a small group of experts whom they repeatedly refer to as hand-picked or hand-selected experts, some Iraqis, Americans, even a few Brits, they say. They were going to prepare some additional programming. They were going to set up an apparatus that could be used to disseminate information, and they were even planning specific programming that would be broadcast after the U.S. took over in Iraq.
It seems like the guiding assumption is that they could have been able to control any and all information going into Iraq and therefore control the population.
That was one of the things that struck me about this document. Mm-hmm. Actually, there were two things. First of all, it's presumptuous in that it seems to assume a considerable degree of U.S. control over the media that would be established in Iraq, whereas clearly Iraqis had their own ideas about what media they would be interested in establishing. I think Iraqis have and had quite a good idea of what propaganda was and were quite capable of making their own judgments about these kinds of things and probably would have welcomed a chance to freely set up their own media. But as said, this document assumes, at least at the outset and for some time, a considerable extent of U.S. control. And in addition, as you said, it also seems to suggest that the Pentagon was anticipating a rather extensive degree of control over the information that was going to be disseminated in Iraq, which, of course, is not at all characteristic of the kind of media world that we have today.
Now, some of the details, there were two consultants who were to be paid $140,000 each for working 6 months, contractors closely connected with White House figures with almost no relevant experience getting these jobs. This all sounds very similar to what was happening at large in Iraq.
That's correct. The planning for the media planning seems, as you said, quite similar to other planning for the U.S. Occupation. I tried to provide some context for what actually happened to the media in Iraq after the U.S. Took over, just because obviously when we're looking at a document like this, we're looking at it from the perspective of what's going on today. And it's clear that the kind of model for a new Arab media that this document outlines as a goal of the United States has not been achieved. And in addition, another irony is that the media environment in Iraq, as we all know, is extremely treacherous. It's one of the most difficult environments, climates in the world for reporters to operate in. So although in some ways the ambitions of this document can be appreciated, in actuality, what has happened in Iraq has been quite far from whatever kind of idealistic goals might have guided the planning.
Now, one of the lines in the report sort of jumped out, this idea that they would, quote, identify the media infrastructure that we need left intact and work with CENTCOM targeters to find alternative ways of disabling key sites, close quote. You sort of allude to this. I'm reading this alongside news about the leaked British document that suggested George W. Bush, in speaking to Prime Minister Tony Blair, brought up the idea of bombing Al Jazeera's offices in Qatar. There have been attacks, as you mentioned, on journalists inside Iraq. And it does give you the sense that taking out undesirable media outlets was part of the plan.
It suggests that, and again, of course, this is a planning document, but it does suggest that if the U.S. government did have plans for what media outlets should be protected, that Al Jazeera's Baghdad Bureau was not one of them, because, of course, Al Jazeera has maintained that they provided quite detailed information to the Pentagon prior to the invasion to make sure that the U.S. government knew where Al Jazeera's offices were.
And finally, do you think there's more coming? Do you think there'll be more documents relating to this released?
I would expect so. We've undertaken a quite extensive FOIA campaign trying to get as many documents declassified as possible about planning for the war. So I'm quite sure that many journalists are doing this as well. And in addition, of course, a number of officials are coming out and providing their own accounts of the war, in part, of course, to try to mitigate their blame for what is generally taken to be a failed policy, so I'm sure that we will find more information.
We've been speaking with Joyce Battle. She is a senior analyst for the National Security Archives projects on South Asia and the Middle East. You can read Iraq, the Media War Plan at nsarchive.org. Joyce Battle, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for inviting me.
Mothers don't need to wait till the official holiday to know what they're getting from the mainstream news media. If the past several years are any indication, it'll be a great big helping of anxiety. For mothers that work outside the home, that they're neglecting their families, and for those that do not, that they're neglecting their social role. They probably won't even bother to wrap it. But it isn't just mothers. Our next guest explains all women, really, are the unlucky recipients of news media's repressive mixed messages about our work, personal, and political lives. Carol Rivers is a journalist, a professor of journalism at Boston University, and author of numerous books, including most recently Selling Anxiety, How the News Media Scare Women. Welcome back to Counterspin, Carol Rivers.
Thank you.
Well, how do news media scare women? What are some of the most predominant storylines in this vein that strike you?
Well, it's interesting because I've been looking at the research on women for the past couple of decades, and I've been struck by the fact that the research and the media storylines are going off in absolutely opposite directions. What the research is showing about working women is that they're doing well, they're high in self-esteem, and yet the media stories are that they're all opting out, that they, if they put their kids in daycare, the kids will be bullies and they'll be wrecks, that if women are too ambitious, men won't like them, that men are being warned not to marry career women because they'll be unhappy. So this incredible dichotomy of sort of misery coming out of the media, while the research data shows quite a different story.
Well, why do you think news media scare women? What drives this framing of things that so ill serves not just women, of course, but really everyone?
Well, the reason I hit on selling anxiety as the title was because it really occurred to me that nowadays women with resources are a very important demographic for the news media. These are women they want to reach because advertisers want to reach them. And just like you can get women to read if you worry about their bodies and their hips and their thighs, you also can make them anxious about their lives and their choices. And those stories have buzz. They're really read. They're the stories that get emailed a lot. They're the stories that get people talking. So I think that, in a way, one of the bad consequences about women being a desirable demographic is that what they're being sold is not very good stuff.
Well, anxiety is arguably the essence of advertising. Is that kind of the idea, that if you sell women and society on the problem, then you can sell them on your preferred solutions, whether those are sending women back to the home or kind of individualized responses to what are really social problems?
It's certainly a part of it. And more, as the news media gets more competitive, journalism is more and more about delivering bodies to advertisers. And while I don't think editors think about that consciously in the front of their heads, it's certainly in the back of their heads that they know there's a certain type of people that the media now wants to reach. And I think that's all a part of the mix.
And you say that these kinds of stories about superwomen and their failures and all of that they generate buzz, and that's partly because, you know, we women and everyone care about these issues. They're real issues. The concern is, of course, just how they're treated in the news media.
They are, and we all know that mixing work and family and all these issues are on the minds of most women. But the trouble is that the story that's really complex and looks at both sides, you know, that's not going to go on page one. That's going to make a cover story. But if you can get a grabby cover line, the opt-out revolution, too smart to marry, these are actual headlines, those headlines they'll move right up to the front, and they'll get buzz. And that, I think, is the buzz is today the driving force behind a number of these stories.
You also note a kind of behind the scenes, if you will, development that's going on, and that's the rise of infotainment, which means, I found it very interesting, it means that a lot of the women in the news pages, you say, are celebrities. So even when we're getting women more in the news, the kind of encroachment of entertainment into news means those women are not necessarily political leaders or civic leaders, but kind of singers and movie stars.
Yeah, at one point I looked at some stats, and Angelina Jolie by far outdrew Condoleezza Rice. So we're seeing a lot of the presentations of women. We're now seeing, you know, young, sexy movie stars as being the people who are most visible at a time when women's voices are really fading from op-ed pages and from commentary. So that's another issue that the women we're tending to see a lot of are very atypical.
And then another piece of that that I also found striking was you found that news media cover feminists, or what they define feminists, as distinct from women, which is, of course, fascinating and, of course, has a real-world impact. What do you suppose is the effect of that?
Well, there's been some studies showing that feminists are covered in a very negative way by the media, that they're seen as strident, shrill, harsh. They're seen as being sort of apart from normal women. And I think what that does is it says that the feminist agenda, which is we need more family-friendly policies, we need more daycare, we need a lot of these things, are kind of demonized and seen as out of the mainstream. And when that happens, what you see is that you lose the political will to try to get some of these programs, which are utterly essential in, you know, sort of the post-industrial world when everybody's working, when 70% of women are in the workforce.
And we've also all heard the stories about young women coming along who benefit from the women's rights movement, but who say they don't identify as feminists. Surely some of that has to do with the kind of connotation that feminist has been given in the news media.
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't identify with a feminist either if I thought that this was some kind of bra-burning, man-hating, never-shave-your-legs kind of person, when, of course, what feminism is really about is in many cases changing the structure so that women, these young women coming up, can be able to have real family lives and can be able to juggle work and family without being, you know, completely exhausted or feeling they have to, opt out. And I'm really worried about this coverage of the opt-out revolution, which says that the best and the brightest young women are leaving the workforce. It's utterly bogus. There is no good information that says that. For 20 years, you look at the trend lines, and what you see is it's constantly upward, except every now and then there's a little drop. And every time there's this small drop, in the early 90s, it was the superwoman is going home stories all over the media. And then recently, it's opt out, the women are all going home. What the research shows you is that the more education a woman has, the better job she has, the less likely she is to drop out when she has children. So the opt-out revolution is really an opt-in revolution, and there are some opt-out, trendlets, but they're presented in the media as being the story when they're not the story.
Well, let me ask you finally, Carol Rivers, you're presenting a book about failures of news media. What's it been like talking to the press about this book?
Mixed. There are some people who really don't want to believe that the media has done such a bad job, but I think I've marshaled an awful lot of evidence. You know, when you have a story that says daycare creates bullies, and you point out that, in fact, 83% of the kids in daycare aren't really that aggressive, and the small percentage of kids who are, the aggression is well within normal range. That's not a scare story. But then when you look at all the headlines, daycare produces bullies, the connection between daycare and bullies, it's pretty stark as to how bad the coverage is.
We've been speaking with Carol Rivers. The book is Selling Anxiety, How the News Media Scare Women. Thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.